schedule. I'm going to essentially just read through this section with you. A good bit of it comes right out of your textbook, this particular, these paragraphs, and so this will just kind of stimulate you to read carefully when you come to that point. But I don't want to just read to you, but if I have any comments, I'll make them. The benefits of legal negativity. What are the benefits? First, when you state laws in a negative fashion, meaning thou shalt not, you are dealing realistically, directly, and plainly with a particular evil. The negative form strives to meet the strong current of evil in the human heart. Let's face it, it's there. And furthermore, and more importantly, it limits the law and the state. The purpose of law is to limit evil, not control people. You want as much freedom for the individual as is possible. When you state law in negative terms, when you say, thou shalt not murder, you do not limit the thousands of ways in which a person might encourage life. Okay? You get the picture? So, the purpose of stating the law in a negative way is to limit the authority of the government, to keep the government off our backs and out of our pocketbooks and out of our homes and out of our schools, and let people have freedom except where evil has to be confronted. That's the purpose of law. Negativity ensures individual liberty except for the prohibited area. For example, a law that says you shall not steal but does not regulate how you might earn honest gain. You can earn honest gain in hundreds of ways. The law simply says you aren't to steal. You cannot earn money in any way that would be essentially stealing from someone else. Negative law permits this comprehensive summarization that we have in the Ten Commandments. In other words, if you didn't have it stated in a negative way, there'd be no way to really summarize what the law is all about. It's easier to state in a few words a command in the negative form than to try to state its opposite in the positive. Your textbook says, our freedom and grace is so great that it would be difficult to give a set of more prescriptions in the positive form with the scope and succinctness with which the Decalogue is presently cast. In other words, you try to present positive law in a succinct way, you just couldn't do it. Now, the context of Mosaic negativity. The law has a loving spirit in its prologue as well as in the main body of its commands. That is almost totally overlooked by modern preachers and even people who ought to know better. The law encourages a course of action because it best reflects the character, nature, and will of God. That's why it's in there. Now, morality and Mosaic negativity. Moral law is always double-sided. Now, I want you to really think through these next statements very carefully. That's why I printed them out for you in detail. Every moral act is at the same time also a refraining from contrary motive action that could have been taken. Refraining from doing a forbidden thing is not moral at all, otherwise a command would be fulfilled by sheer inactivity. Is a corpse moral? Now stop and think about it. Is a corpse moral? It doesn't commit adultery. Doesn't rob, steal. No. Are you being moral by simply being locked up in a room somewhere where you do not have the opportunity to do certain kinds of conduct? No. Now, consequently, this is important, when an evil is forbidden in one of the commands, we're talking about the Ten Commandments, an evil is committed, is prohibited, like murder, theft, its opposite good must be practiced before one can be called obedient. Now, read that through again. Let's go over that. It's extremely important. When an evil is forbidden in one of the commands, its opposite good must be practiced before one can be called obedient. Take a command. Thou shalt not murder. We haven't had a murder in the history of Florida Christian College. But let's turn that around. If morality involves performing the opposite of murder, then what does that involve? What does that require? If we're going to be obedient to the command, thou shalt not murder, then in a positive way, what should we all be doing every day?
Forgiving, loving our brother, giving life.
What?
Giving life.
How?
Building others up.
Protecting life.
Okay. Is that all you can come up with? How about thou shalt not commit adultery? Morally, then, what are we required to do?
Be faithful.
Be faithful. Promote what? What should we be promoting? Particularly, what kind of faithfulness?
Marital
faithfulness. The home. And not doing anything by way of our action that would in any way be a detriment to the home or to faithfulness on the part of another person. Now, the next thing. To reject virtue is to choose vice. Thus, the absence of positive moral action has the force of rejecting that value or virtue. To reject virtue is to choose vice. Now, observe very carefully and read through these next two statements very carefully. The law speaks to specific acts and attitudes, but one has not complied with the law by simply not going, quote, all the way. The law speaks also to all incidents, enticements, or pressures that lead to the forbidden act. Let's analyze that. Let's analyze that in terms of thou shalt not murder. Have you obeyed that law when you pulverize a guy and you leave him, he's still breathing? You beat him over the head with a wrench. He's got blood spurting from ears, eyes, nose, and mouth. But he's still breathing. And so you say, well, I didn't kill him. I haven't broken the law. Have you? What are we saying? When you have the forbidden act out here, which is murder, any action that points in the direction of murder is therefore also forbidden. You say, well, that's kind of far-fetched. Well, let's bring it home. Something that maybe you can relate to a little bit. There are students right here at this school, when it comes to sexual morality, who think as long as they don't, quote, go all the way, they haven't broken the law. They're still being moral. They're obeying the scriptures. Thus you will find boys and girls fondling each other, laying all over one another, doing all kinds of acts short of sexual penetration itself. And they think, I haven't broken the law. I haven't gone, quote, all the way. But observe what your textbook writer is trying to get across. That in biblical law, when an act is forbidden, out here adultery, which incorporates all manner of sexual immorality, then any act that moves in that direction, or any enticement to move in that direction, is wrong. And you are not moral by simply avoiding going all the way. See, that's the way the Pharisees. We have too much Phariseeism. Where the Pharisees would say, well, as long as you don't go all the way, and whatever it is, whether it's murder, adultery, or whatever, you're okay, you're moral. You can come right up to the edge, and you're okay. But that's not the biblical view of morality. Yes?
Isn't that what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount? He said, you know, they've said to you, do not commit adultery. I say to you, it starts when you look at a woman and you lust after her in your heart.
Exactly.
Don't do
Jesus was telling us what the true intent of the law of Moses was. You understand that? Jesus was not introducing a new law. He was saying, this is what the law meant in the first place. But because of your Pharisaic attitude, you missed the point. So he makes it very clear. So we have none less authority than Jesus to back up what we're trying to say. That it's not just the act itself, the forbidden act, which is immoral. It is any inducement, enticement toward that forbidden act. Anything that would entice a woman to commit adultery or a man to commit adultery or some other sexual immorality is immoral. When it comes to murder, any type of violent behavior, anger, murder starts with anger. Any type of anger, Jesus talked about even raising your voice and calling names. You see, and this is why we need to teach. See, law isn't taught. This is the only time, this is the second time or third time in history we ever taught this course around here. People need to understand that. We have people here with terrible tempers. I've heard of them. And they say some terrible things when they get angry. Things that tend toward murder. And morally, they have broken the law. You see, by moving in that direction. Now remember the opposite. If the law says, thou shalt not kill, then we must do everything to promote life. Everything from helping the sick, being kind to people who are in physical distress. Do you understand what I'm saying? If the law says thou shalt not murder, we cannot sit on our hands when someone has a physical need and ignore that need. Do you understand what the law is trying to say? Okay, there's a lot more to these laws than meet the eye. Now, let's get into our second lesson as these things begin to unfold. Now, we know very clearly, all through the Pentateuch, that the law of God, the source of the law, is God himself. And the mediator of the law is Moses. We find that all through the biblical writers, both Old and New Testaments, that Moses is the giver of the law. And there were three historical settings in which the law was given. We think mostly at Mount Sinai, but there were some laws given when they were camped at Kadesh Barnea, and more still when they were camped on the plains of Moab. God had special communication with Moses, as a friend would talk face to face. So God spoke to Moses. The backdrop of the law is the Exodus. The Exodus from Egypt, the deliverance from Egypt, was that decisive moment in Israel's history. The Exodus was to the ancient Israelites what the resurrection is to us. And on the background of what God had done for them, he asked them and expects them to keep his law. The foundation of the law is the covenant. God chose Israel to be his people. Israel agreed to accept the position as God's people. And so the law of Moses, what we call the law of Moses, the law of God, sets forth the terms of that agreement. God says, I choose you to be my people. Do you accept? Israel says, yes, we accept. Then God says, this is how you behave if you're going to be my people. So that's the foundation of the law. Now, let's take a look at the Ten Commandments as an overview now. We're going to come back and look at each commandment separately, so we don't want to get into that. But I call the Decalogue the law condensed. It's the law in a nutshell. I want you to know the two locations, chapter locations of the law. Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. I don't care if you know the verses or not. In Deuteronomy, you have three minor variations on the statements as they appear in Exodus. We'll look at those minor variations a little bit later on. You will memorize the Ten Commandments as they appear in Exodus. I want you to memorize the 17 verses of Exodus. First 17 verses, Exodus 20. And we will do that a little bit at a time, so don't worry about it. We're going to do one each week, a little bit along the way. We'll just keep going over and over until we have it all learned, okay? All right. Now, where did the terminology Decalogue come from? within our hearts that keeps us from sinning, from doing anything that would be abhorrent to God. You know what's going to happen to some of you as we go through this class together? Your conscience is going to be pricked about certain acts and certain deeds that you had no concept were wrong. And you're going to experience exactly what the Apostle Paul experienced when he said, if it hadn't been for the law, I wouldn't have known what sin was. Part of the purpose of the law is to educate our conscience, to make us aware of what sin is. And God says, I gave you these Ten Commandments so that the fear of the Lord will be in your heart, that you might not sin. Because the violation of biblical law is violating that which is abhorrent and unpleasant and unattractive and unsuitable to God. And that constitutes sin. What does the New Testament say? Sin is the transgression of the law. Okay. Now, Jesus then summarized commands 1, 2, 3, and 4 when he said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. He's quoting Deuteronomy 6, 5. He says the whole first half of the Ten Commandments summarized right there, Deuteronomy 6, 5. Commandments 5 through 10, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's quoting Leviticus 19, 18. See, Jesus is not the first one to say love your neighbor as yourself. It's found right here in the law of Moses. That summarizes the second half of the law. You say, but you can't command love. Depends on how you define love. You can't command an emotional. I cannot command you to have an emotional feeling that Hollywood calls love toward anybody. It's either there or it's not. The chemistry is either there or it isn't. Is that kind of love essential to marriage? That kind of love comes and goes, folks. Hollywood kind of emotional love comes and goes. It comes and goes before marriage, and it comes and goes after marriage. And some days you wake up and you don't feel like you have that kind of love. But usually, if you have love in the biblical sense of the word, which is commitment, and you hang in there, the other kind of love will come back. It comes and goes. It has a lot to do with how we feel physically at the time. It's hard to really get very romantic when you've got a throbbing headache or you've got an abscessed tooth or you've got kids that have squalled all day long. Hard to really get romantic. But to see biblical love, the kind of love that can be commanded, is an act of will. And that's why, you see, the marriages we read about in the Bible, there was no courtship that we go through in Western society. You didn't have courtship because, you see, the emotional love, what's nice and what's there, is not essential. The kind of love that's essential to a marriage is commitment. The kind of love that says, I will always act. I commit myself to always act in the best interest of this person to whom I'm committing myself. That person commits likewise to me. That kind of love can be commanded. That's why the Bible says, husbands, love your wives. God, not even God can command us to have love in the emotional Hollywood sense. It's just either there or it's not. That kind of love that God said for husbands to have for their wives is not Hollywood kind of love. It's commitment. It's acting in the best interest of that spouse. So God says here, you are to love me, not with a Hollywood emotional kind of love, but with a commitment to do what I've commanded you to do. So God can command that kind of love. Now, the Mosaic codes, and I want you to know the location of these codes and their names. Location meaning chapter location. I don't care about the verses. The first is called the covenant code. This is what I call the law amplified. Now, these three codes, you have the covenant code, the holiness code, and the Deuteronomic code, the code of Deuteronomy. The covenant code is found in Exodus 20 through 23. We get the title from chapter 24 and verse 7. Somebody read that verse for me right quick. 24:7. What does it say? Somebody read.
Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all of the words said we will do, we will do.
The book of the covenant. So we call this the covenant code. The critics claim that the covenant code was not written until the early monarchy, about 400 years after Moses. And we don't have time to argue with that particular position in this class. If you're interested in it, take the class in Old Testament criticism. I just simply call that to your attention because it is a fact. We're accepting this as Mosaic origin. Now, there are two kinds of law forms. I've already mentioned to you casuistic law. What is casuistic law?
Case-by-case
law. We also have apodictic law. Now, that's the Ten Commandments, the thou shalt nots. Notice, the Ten Commandments don't say, if you come upon a man and you fall upon him, do not kill him. It says, thou shalt not kill. That's called apodictic, absolute edicts, categorical law. And what you have in the covenant code, this section of Exodus, known as the covenant code, chapters 20, 21, 22, and 23, it starts out with apodictic law, and it concludes with apodictic law, and sandwiched in between is a section of casuistic law. Do you see that from the references that I give? A mixture of these two different kinds of law mingled together. Casuistic law is basically an expression of the Decalogue as applied to specific temporal situations, specific cases. Now, it's interesting in the covenant code that it starts and ends with commitment to worship, a call to worship. He starts out with the law of the altar, and he concludes this section with the law of the festivals. In both, he begins and he ends the covenant code with man's responsibility to God. And that sort of gives the flavor of the law of Moses. Our obligations to our fellow man is always within the context and framework of our obligation to God. Now, verses 22 and 23, Exodus 20, talks about the fountainhead of the law, which is God himself, just like it is with the Ten Commandments. Let's read verses 22 and 23, Exodus 20. Who has it? Martha, do you have it?
Then the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. Ye shall not make other gods besides me, gods of silver, gods of gold, ye shall not make for yourselves.
Okay, so you see here, just as the Ten Commandments were introduced with a verse or two that set the stage and tell us this comes from God, so the covenant code also starts with a similar declaration, the divine origin of these laws. The law is an expression of God's will, and crimes against the law are what we call sin. Israel is responsible to a sole lawgiver. Now that's an extremely important point. Pagan people in the ancient world were responsible to all these different gods. The Israelites were responsible to one lawgiver, meaning, of course, God himself. Civil, moral, religious obligations are all combined in the law since they all come from God, is the idea. Now notice the recipients of the law. He says in verse 22, set the law before the people, not before the lawyers, but before the people. The law was designed to prevent the emergence of a special legal class who had private custody of the law. Unfortunately, that is not the case in America today. We are all prohibited, except in small claims court, from doing almost anything for ourselves legally. We cannot really effectively represent ourselves in courts of law. We have to have an advocate who has passed his bar exam. And here in Florida a few years ago, we had a woman who was a very knowledgeable legal person who was giving help to poor people, helping them get their legal forms, and now she's been sent to jail because she's practicing law when she wasn't a lawyer. But you see, that's not the way it was with the biblical law. It was designed for the common man, the common people. Set the law before the people. Most of us never even see a law that's passed in Tallahassee. What we see are summaries that appear in the newspaper. Biblical laws for the people. Okay. Now, the outline of the covenant code, I have an appendix in your syllabus, but just to give you a quick overview of it, we find in the covenant code cases particularly dealing with slaves, different kinds of homicide, bodily injuries, property damage, society as a whole, justice and neighborliness, sacred seasons, and then it closes out with an epilogue, as we talked about in the first hour. That's normally the pattern. Prologue, then the laws, and then the epilogue. You'll find that in Appendix 1 in the back of your syllabus. You don't have to worry about copying it down, just to give you an idea of what's covered in the covenant code. Now, the holiness code, Exodus 18, 19, and 20. Remember the locations. That's my quiz for next week. Where are the Ten Commandments found? Where are these different codes found? What are the names of these codes? You got that down? Will everybody make 100 next week? I told you exactly what I'm going to ask you. Anybody doesn't make 100 next week ought to be ashamed of themselves. Now, the title, Holiness Code, we cannot produce that directly from the text like we can the name Covenant Code. This term, Holiness Code, was introduced by a scholar named Klosterman back in 1877. He included chapter 17 in his analysis, but I'm inclined to think that chapter 17 perhaps more realistically belongs with the first 16 chapters rather than with the last part of the book. The critical view of the Holiness Code is that it goes back to the exilic period 900 years after Moses. Again, I don't have time to argue that point. Just to make you aware of it, we believe Moses is the mediator of the Holiness Code just like he is of the Covenant Code. The structure of the Holiness Code, see,